Hi, Matt.
Henry, how you doing?
Not too bad, and yourself?
I'm doing well. Anyone ever call you Hank, or is it just always Henry? It's all
I used to be called Hank when I was in grad school here back in the mid-90s, but my wife does not like Hank, so she has basically forbidden any mention of the word. So I'm Henry pretty well all the time.
Okay. Well, you can call
me... I'll answer to Hank pretty happily, but I'm a Henry.
Well, let's talk about pirates.
Okay. Well, it's a big story at the moment, and so... I was thinking it's also kind of fun for one particular libertarian professor, who's Peter Leeson, who's in George Mason University. And he's got a book which is coming out, which is called The Invisible Hook, which is all about the law and economics of piracy. And I guess on the one hand, he's thinking that this is great, that people are going to want to buy books about pirates. But on the other hand, he's trying to present a kind of a positive, affirming image of how pirates ought to be thought of as a kind of model for how libertarians can get their stuff together without state action. And maybe that's a tougher case to sell when you've got pirates taking U.S. ships and holding U.S. Captains for ransom and all of those bad things.
We've got a review by Catherine Mangu Ward of The Invisible Hook coming out in our June issue. And I haven't read the book, but I did read and edit the review with delight. It seems like a fun idea. From what I gather, Leeson's talking a lot about it's sort of the question of how do these people organize themselves and what were their incentive structure and what does that tell us about our traditional notions of what pirates were like. And in that, he finds that their way of kind of organizing is sort of peculiar. Portrays sort of a difference between the standard kind of ship and crew in the traditional seafaring world and how at the close of, I forget whatever war it was, suddenly it was pretty hard to make a decent living, and ships' captains worked as kind of like absolute authorities, and their incentive structure was to treat their crews like crap because they were basically trying to defend the ship and preserve whatever investment that there was. The pirates, on the other hand, had sort of living constitutions, literally, apparently, according to the book, where everyone had voting rights. They had periodic elections of both the captain and the sort of number two. They had they were racially integrated in a way that was a little bit more advanced than the society at large, although I guess he points out in the book that that's not out of any benighted tolerance or anything like that. It was just sort of like, well, who can we get as a pirate? And everyone sort of shared equally in the booty, and it was all about dividing up the spoils accurately, which is a pretty interesting way of looking at it. And as part of that, their economic incentive structure was to really try to exaggerate their own sense of menace and threat. They needed people to be scared crapless by hearing or seeing, the skull and bones flag, so that they would surrender without a fight, handing them the booty, handing them the plans, and all those kind of stuff. And so in order to kind of keep that reputation alive, they did have to engage in the odd, horrible maiming, rape, and torture, and whatnot. But it's a very interesting look. I don't know how much the book claims to, teach us something about the way that we should or have organized ourselves now. Certainly that wasn't the emphasis of our review, but it is interesting to note, among other things, that the dawn of what we consider piracy, it wasn't about sort of these fiendish, stateless outlaws. It was state-sponsored piracy that the British Crown and others delighted in.
Yeah, no, that's right. Now, I've got to say, I haven't read the book. I've read some of the papers, which I guess are being popularized for the book, and I find it a fun set of arguments, although I've got to say I'm pretty skeptical about some of the claims he makes. I am not an expert on pirates, but I have done work on the Sicilian Mafia, so looking at the way that they organize doesn't...
Did you say Sicilian or Brazilian?
The Sicilian, the original. Yeah, the original. So anyway, I guess I've got some academic hang-ups about probably some of the arguments, but as I say, I haven't read it, so I want to read it before I make any final judgments. But I guess the underlying question here, I think, is that there is a kind of a normative claim that he's trying to make here, which is that we should be paying more attention to these societies in which people make these kinds of free covenants or compacts or constitutions or whatever it is that you want to call them. And he's got a new article, I think, coming out with Public Choice, where he basically makes the argument that in certain ways this is a this is like a utopian version, which is a little bit like what Buchanan and Tulloch, these two famous public choice professors who argued about constitutions, that these pirates basically managed to do what they were supposed to do, and even more so. So I think he is making a kind of argument here, but I think that if we look at Somalia at the moment, we can maybe think a little bit about that argument, because you know, Somalia, from the point of view of certain libertarians at least, ought to be a ought to be about as good as you can get. You've got no real state power, no state authority. You've got sort of everything being done basically by these dudes who've tooled up with machine guns. And so the question is, you know, sort of, and again, I want to say this is clearly not what all libertarians believe. There's a lot of difference among them, but there's a certain libertarian view of government which is, I think, is we've got a pretty good example of what that looks like in Somalia. And maybe if you like Somalia, that's wonderful. If not, then maybe not so much.
I always find it kind of flattering on behalf of the subset of quarreling humans who allow themselves to be described as libertarians, that almost alone in the pantheon of possible political identities, libertarians are expected to embrace the most extreme example of, or like, you know, if you followed your logic all the way to the end, you would in fact be a Somali pirate. No one ever says the same thing about contemporary liberalism, you know, Kennedy liberalism, progressivism, and all these kind of things. It's just not part of the, you know, what is the logical conclusion of national greatness conservatism? Well, I don't know. It's a question that somehow is asked of libertarians, but not really the world as a whole. I mean, I think, you know, there is a strain, and there always has been, in libertarianism of anarchism, which isn't in itself necessarily libertarian. A lot of people who consider themselves anarchists probably think libertarians are devils, and vice versa. I think the average person who allows himself to be described as libertarian sees, you know, a role for a government here and there. You know, it's not a bunch of people trying to, you know, tear down every fire station on every block and to delegitimize every street because it happens to be owned by the public. It's more of a broader kind of idea that all else being equal, you know, in a place that has the rule of law, which is another point that is of some interest to people from the libertarian aisle, you know, that we should see how are people organizing themselves and are they doing it in such a way that is sufficient that doesn't require a lot of monkeying by the heavy hand of a federal government, then maybe we shouldn't, you know, sort of be allow the government to be the architects of their world. That is a lot different than, you know, let's just have no government and every man, you know, with a gun to himself. I don't see anything in Somalia that sees that looks like a paradise to me. And frankly, you know, there's always a strain within libertarianism of oh, let's start like a free state project. Let's start you know, a city that is only, you know, a bunch of libertarians will gather and they'll create their own sort of contract city. Or, you know, this is always popular. Let's you know, go to some island in the Barbados and create this idealized libertarian society. And with much respect for everybody who's coming up with great ideas, that all sounds to me personally just like a terrible nightmare. A society that's organized around people who broadly share my political beliefs sounds to me about as exciting as pulling out my own teeth. I just I don't want to be around people who think like me because that just strikes me as sort of weird. But speaking of people who think like one another, we have tomorrow a bunch of tea, what are they calling them, tea bag parties?
Well, can I just respond to you
sure.
on the pirate thing? Because I think, you know, on the one hand, you're right. And, I, you know, as I was saying, I'm not trying to hang this particular thing around the neck of all libertarians. But on the other hand, I do think that there is a tendency within libertarianism to, and within the organized forms of libertarianism, to embrace the crazy to a somewhat greater extent than is seen in other parts of the political spectrum. And here, Joseph, you talked about these utopian schemes, which I kind of am fond of the people who are doing this. You know, so I think that we could have a little bit more, we could do with a little bit more utopianism in American politics. But I also think, you know, so we see, for example, I think it was last week that Cato held a panel on seasteading, you know, which is a particularly crazy version of this argument. Basically, this idea that we can all go out to sea and have these floating maritime communities, which will be free from the law and will be able to sort of escape from the tyranny of states. And now I'm sure that the panel was probably composed of people who were as much critical of this notion as people who were proposing it. But I also don't think that you see panels at, say, the American Progress people, where they're mounting panels on monopolizing the means of production and taking it over, good or bad idea. So I think there is a little bit more crazy being embraced in the libertarian movement, not to say that all libertarians are crazy by any stretch of the imagination, not even to say that it's necessarily all bad, because I think a bit of utopianism is not a bad thing, but it does seem to me that there is a little bit more official, well, quasi-official embrace of some of the more far-out notions within libertarianism than there are in other parts of the political community.
A couple of points on that. One is that anytime you have a two-party system, that is entrenched, I mean, it's a legalized two-party system, all third parties are going to look half insane. There's no getting around it, because they're going to attract the kind of people who, you know, intrinsically do not want to be part of a majoritarian culture. And so they're going to go with enthusiasm to enthusiasm and try out different models that are futile in many ways on their face, and yet go through it anyways. And when you're in that position of minority, you don't really get to spend a lot of time picking and choosing, you know, who gets to belong to your minority fringe. That doesn't, of course, stop every third party from having, constant internecine warfare and putches and things like that. The Libertarian Party is especially talented at that. But in general, third parties in a place where the two-party system is rigged are always going to sound at least half crazy. Another thing is that, though, to give the half crazy their due, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, it was a half crazy notion when you say we shouldn't have a military draft. This was an outlying thing. Every major Western democracy had a military draft, just like they tell us about these days. You know, every major democracy has state subsidies for television, and so therefore America should start bailing out their newspapers, which is an awful, awful idea. And libertarians for a long time were sort of lonely, saying actually conscription is among the most evil things that a country can do and a government can do. Eventually, a position that seemed totally crazy became mainstream, became policy, became accepted. Same thing has happened with all kinds of things like airline deregulation, trucking deregulation, things that we now sort of take for granted. Why should the government be setting prices for, you know, the price of the cost of a sandwich on an airplane, which it used to do? That was a lonely position in 1971 that Reason Magazine and the back issues that are behind me as we sit were talking about, knowing that sounded crazy to the generalized audience, yet trying to explain why maybe that's okay. And I, you know, this is not an elaborate defense of seasteading. I think, what the hell, you know, it's harmless. If it's not going to hurt me, do what you like. You know, string together a bunch of old 2-liter bottles and go crazy. It's not personally my cup of tea. I don't, at the same time, see it as anything that's sort of dangerous. And it's an interesting intellectual idea, of whether it's sort of a secession within a broader state, or just like, are there places where people can go where they don't belong to a country? You know, eventually that's going to be an issue if we ever colonize the moon or whatever the hell. So I don't see this as some kind of dire, like, oh my God, these Dungeons and Dragons kids are going to take us down, you know, anytime soon. And I'm not, you know, I'm not worried about eccentricity at the end of the day. I mean, the Center for American Progress, I'm much more worried tangibly about what they think is a good idea with my tax dollars than by any eccentricity of a marginalized sort of fringe character talking about pie-in-the-sky ideas on the libertarian fringe. We're talking about people who want to spend tons of money bailing out banks, bailing out Chrysler and GM, and also sort of keeping their gravy train open to and from the government. That, to me, is much more perfidious and yet is sort of accepted without comment.
Well, I would say two things in response to you. So maybe we'll get off this because I think we agree on a fair amount of this. First is to say I think we both agree that a certain amount of the crazy can be a good and a useful thing because sometimes crazy ideas turn out to be less crazy on examination than they might look to be at first. The second thing is, you know, that in some respects the sort of criticisms you're making of the American Progress people, you know, there are problems that Cato, I think, has been grappling with and grappled sort of during the Bush administration, where my perception as an outsider was that there were some people within Cato who were sort of quite happy with the Bush administration and who didn't want to necessarily rock the boat all that much as long as taxes were being lowered, even if the fiscal position didn't look all that great, at least they're going in the right direction. There were other people who felt that this was a bad idea. And of course, there was a very big split that was, I think, pretty public apparent over the question of the Iraq war and whether or not going to war and under these circumstances should be considered to be a libertarian or non-libertarian idea. So I think you're right about the fact that sort of the closer you are to the center of power, the more likely it is that there will be opportunities for corruption. I think that sort of libertarians are maybe in a slightly unusual position in this, in that, as you say, they're not part of the mainstream of either party. But by the same token, I think there are certain cross pressures which I don't think Cato, by any stretch of the imagination, was immune from during the years of the Bush administration. And I suspect that it's a lot more comfortable for Cato at the moment to be on the sort of outside again, rather than trying to think about what kinds of political compromises are the right ones to make.
I'll let Cato defend themselves. I think broadly speaking, they were not a very pro-Bush outfit, certainly for the last 4 years. And I would have a difficult time assessing otherwise. The people I know there are no fans of Bush or the modern Republican Party. I'll talk for reason for a second. And that reason, before I started working here, which was in 2003, and I've come back and forth between them, but reason has been very early and I think consistently highly, highly, highly critical of Bush and the modern Republican Party. And I mean, there's an interesting split that we probably shouldn't get into, but I think older libertarians, the Republican Party seemed more of a natural home because there was a tradition, and there is an active tradition within the Republican Party of at least mouthing a certain amount of small government principles, even though very few people, almost nobody, actually governs by them. But also there was sort of a broader anti-communism tent and some other kind of traditions that overlapped. But I think basically, libertarians younger than me, there aren't a lot of people. There are some, but there aren't a lot who sort of feel comfortable certainly with Bushism, but also with the Republican Party, outside of maybe Ron Paul or some other people. It doesn't seem like, why would we have any kind of alliance with those people? But, I mean, again, I don't want to speak for the entire world there. I personally find it to be a much more, autonomous position to be in as a human being, not to be tethered to any of these, goddamn political parties, including the Libertarian Party. As a journalist, and I would hope as an academic, you just sort of want to follow where your discipline takes you, and that rarely, for me, takes me to a place where group membership is considered important.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely fair enough, and and my impression is, like yours, that it's a generational thing, and I think a lot of it has to do with culture and lifestyle issues, that it seems to me that younger libertarians are uncomfortable with some of the compromises that older libertarians made on issues such, culture issues such as gay rights and whatever. And here I'm thinking particularly of Will Wilkinson a couple of months ago with his thing about how he didn't want to be attached to a party of, I can't remember, but basically religious bigots who are into fag bashing, I think was more or less the words he used to describe the Republican Party.
I, on one level, agree very strongly with Will about that, and I think that Republicans have dug a very significant grave for themselves among people who are under 30 with the real and perceived, you know, sort of fag bashing and kind of grumpy old white menness in general, and that just doesn't play among people under 30. They don't even know what you're talking about. Like, what planet do you live on? Where I probably disagree with Will is that he sees he's you know, very interested in this broad kind of libertarian project. Where you know, libertarians like him are going to kind of work on liberals to you know, help gently persuade them that maybe the answer to questions of public policy aren't always an aggrandizement of power on the federal level, and that there are different ways to achieve shared goals. I think sometimes what liberals get wrong about libertarians is that they assume that the goal is A, all about taxes, and B, like, you know, can we kick someone on welfare in the teeth? And they don't see it as more that there are people who just think that a better way to have a more just, a more prosperous, a more interesting society is if the government concentrates on things that a government should do and not necessarily hire and fire CEOs of various companies. And so Will has this sort of a long-range libertarian project, which is very interesting, I think, on an academic kind of level, on the nitty-gritty level of, like, this, you know, influencing the Democratic Party or, you know, just sort of broad trends of liberalism in any appreciable way. I personally don't have a lot of hope for it. I mean, I've seen a lot of you know, we see this at Reason all the time, and it's very funny and peculiar, you know, sort of lefty bloggers or commentators found Reason to be incredibly useful and relevant and topical when we're bashing Bush every day. Or in my case, I wrote a book about John McCain that wasn't particularly flattering, and it got probably the best notices in the liberal press. But you know, that didn't mean that people sort of bought into the critique or where the critique came from. It's sort of like that was a useful club that someone just laid on my table. And then as soon as Obama became president, they went through the same kind of marginalization methods that the right used against them at the, you know, with the onset of the Iraq War and the adoption of the Patriot Act. I mean, some of the same exact language. Like, no serious person, which is something I think Matthew Iglesias said at one point, no serious person would argue that it isn't a smart thing to do to, you know, give money to the states to cover their budget deficits or something as part of a stimulus. And this is the same guy, and I like Matt, it's the same guy who, you know, complained sort of bitterly and sarcastically about the usage of very serious person by, you know, Washington Republicans in 2002 and 2003, who used that as a way to marginalize debate about the war, because all serious people knew that you had to do X, Y, and Z in the Middle East, or else you weren't a worthy foreign policy commentator. So it's a long way of saying that, you know, if you look for alliances, certainly in a temporal way, they will last as long as the next election cycle. And so ultimately, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time trying to convince people of my bizarre worldview.
Well, this, I guess, it's actually a good segue. The other two topics, the major topics we're going to talk about, I think, are the sort of the tax thing and sort of global warming. You could actually segue into either from here. But let's talk about taxes and the teabaggers, which I think, you know, first of all, it's perhaps the most unfortunate name for a political movement yet invented. I was just looking at Ezra Klein, managed to get this wonderful clip from MSNBC, in which this news commentator for 3 minutes is trying to work every possible double entendre that he possibly can into description of the teabagging movement, you know, sort of finishing with a description of how sort of the how Dick Armey is going to be sort of an essential part of the movement. So, but apart from that, there was an interesting piece by Dave Weigel in the Washington Independent today, which is, I think, the biggest or most extensive account I've seen of the teabag movement to date, which talks about some of the tricky issues that maybe are being navigated. And here, I think, reading this piece, I think it's pretty clear that, to me, that Paul Krugman's piece, where he basically argued that this was all astroturf by the Republicans, is it's exaggerated. I don't think that's true, but that there's a real sort of question there as to how far this movement sort of wants to, you know, sort of is on sort of parts of it clearly are being organized by the Republican Party. Parts of it are being organized by people who don't necessarily want to have anything to do with the Republican Party. And people are trying to confront, including libertarians, the question of how far do they want to be associated with, say, for example, people like Newt Gingrich. It starts with a quote from a libertarian who says, you know, well, I wanted to be part of this until Newt got involved in then as a result of that, and given the ways in which Newt has compromised, I basically decided to get out. So what's your view of the grand teabagging Dick Armey movement?
I think that you know, we could have had this mirror of a conversation 4 years ago talking about International Answer and anti-war protests. International Answer is, you know, vaguely Stalinist. Can you be vaguely Stalinist? That's kind of difficult. Organization that happens to, you know, be better at putting together anti-war protests than most other people. And so what you saw back then was that almost every single large protest, or even small one, you get an army of Michelle Malkins out there with cameras looking for the person who is saying, you know, Mumia was right, go kill a cop, or whatever. You know, the same thing actually happened in immigration protests in L.A., which I covered. You know, you could be at a protest with 100,000 people, and, you know, the number of American flags outnumbered Mexican or Salvadoran flags by, like, 20 to 1, and you betcha that anti-immigration bloggers, very active in the blogosphere, would find whatever most alarming, you know, kind of Aztec flag that they could. It's an old game to sort of look at how weird street protesters are, and there's no question that they're weird and inherently funny on some level. And you know, the way that we all kind of process them, the way the media processes them, is just very kind of sporadic. It's incoherent. It sort of depends on the mood of the time. I'll never forget being in New York for the Republican convention of 2004, and we've kind of scrubbed this from our collective national memory, which strikes me as bizarre, but there was something like 200,000 people marching against the war and against Republicans in New York then, and it was just kind of treated with a shrug. It was very, very weird. I won't put the, you know, whatever teabag protest is going on in Washington in that same context necessarily. I will say that it is interesting that this is popping up all over the country. I think that there's definitely a bit of spontaneity to this, that the, you know, vast right-wing conspiracy hounds out there are perhaps at least somewhat in denial about. You know, I think that every conspiracy that it involves, like, who's making this an AstroTurf thing, involves, if I'm not mistaken, Charles Koch, who's a big funder of libertarian things. And I just got to say that if that is true, you would think that maybe some people who are, you know, occasional recipients of that funding or who live in that universe would have heard about it or been active. I mean, we've written very little about the teabag protest, probably to our discredit. We'll be covering it a little bit more tomorrow. But I mean, it's just not something that keeps me up at night. So, long-winded way of saying, yeah, they're funny. At the same time, I think they do reveal, whether, no matter how opportunistic it is, and I think it really is opportunistic. I want to go out there and ask people, like, why weren't you protesting a year ago? I mean, Bear Stearns happened in March, and George W. Bush grew the government by levels not seen since Lyndon Johnson, and he was a bigger regulator since Nixon, you know, and where all these sort of principled small government people back when their party was in power. So I have a sort of a cynical take on that. But at the same time, I think that their existence helps illustrate that there's a big part about Obama's approach to the economic crisis right now that is fundamentally unpopular. They don't prove that, but I think that they are somewhat of an indicator of that. What I mean is that the bailout and all bailouts are unpopular. I don't think there's been a single bit of polling I've seen anywhere in 6 months that suggests that bailing out a bailed company with taxpayer money is a popular move. And that's an actual problem that Obama has, not just of governance, but of popularity. And he's a politician. He has to respond to that. And there's an element of which that these protests, I think, channel that and perhaps, you know, sort of whip it up more. And that is a real thing. And I think that anger, furthermore, is completely justified. There is something fundamentally unfair about taking my money, taking your money, and saying, okay, we're going to use this money to give to this company because that company failed. It just doesn't make intuitive sense. It doesn't make any kind of fairness sense, and that's a real problem that Obama will have.
Well, you know, let me just quickly say about the teabaggers before we get to the broader question of what's fair or unfair with regard to bailouts. I think it is similar in some ways to the answer thing, but there are also some other things going on as well, which is to say, I think, you know, on the one hand, there's the crazies versus non-crazies thing, which is a problem that clearly the answer protests had, that a bunch of the people who are organizing were not necessarily the people who you would have liked to have seen taking the forefront of this. But one of the reasons that they were able to do this was because the mainstream didn't want to touch it with a barge pole, and in particular the Democratic Party did not want to touch it with a barge pole. And this is, I think, this means that the problem is somewhat different from what you see with the teabag people, where you do see the Republicans, I think, very clearly seeing this as a means that they can sort of try to capitalize on some stuff. And, you know, very clearly Republicans are speaking at a number of these events. Weigel, again, I think this piece is very good, talking about the sort of the differences and some of the disputes that have resulted as a result of that. But we do see the Republicans, you know, basically trying to turn this, as best they can, into a broader movement. And we see, I think, Fox News pretty demonstrably trying to hype it up for all that it's worth. So I think there is somewhat of a difference, at least different problems that we're talking about here. It's not so much a problem of the crazies versus the non-crazies, although I'm sure that they'll be able to find some, you know, sort of some people at these movements who are going to be claiming, you know, so we need to go back on the gold standard or whatever. It's more of a problem that I think has been confronted within the movement of, you know, sort of how far do you want to align yourself with the political interests of the Republican Party. And, you know, so this, you know, so given that Dick Armey and Newt Gingrich, and these are the people whose names I've heard much more than sort of any of the Ed Koch funded stuff, given that these people have these interests, how far do you want to get into bed with them on this stuff? On the sort of broader question of taxes, I think that, you know, I think you're absolutely right. There is a clear sense among a lot of people that sort of that the bailout is is unjustified. Whether or not that's a whether or not the bailout is unjustified, I think there's a I don't like the bailout. I do reluctantly think that it was probably the right thing. And here I'm thinking in particular of a well-known basically libertarian person I know, and I think you're at the same event, who was arguing off the record, well, this was about as this was about what you would have expected if you had a bunch of libertarians sort of making the decisions. So in other words, this is a kind of minimal response. And looking at the politics of some of the sort of members of the Federal Reserve, you do actually, you might expect them to move in a pro-libertarian rather than an anti-libertarian direction on this. Whether or not this is going
to... I'm sorry, can I interrupt, but what was that referring to specifically? Like the moment that the response that was perceived to be like...
This is, you know, sort of talking primarily about Fed. You know, so this is this was a off the record event, so I don't want to say who was saying it, but I think you were at the event. I think it's an event that you've been at least one or two of the series.
The Libertarian Dinner thing.
The Libertarian Dinner parties.
I was just at the one with Mark Schmidt.
Okay.
I wrote about it, so if it was off the record, someone forgot to tell me.
Okay. Well, then. Well.
Sorry, Mark.
Well, yeah, well, I think it's semi off the record. But anyway, I'm incorrect in my recollection then. But the argument that was being made was, well, if you look at the Federal Reserve people, the people who are actually members of this Board of Governors or whatever the hell it's called, a significant number of these people are, and sort of would appear to have libertarian inclinations. They had effective veto power. They did not exercise this veto power, and therefore the argument that was being made, and this was by somebody who I think is very definitely perceived as being on the libertarian end of the spectrum, this is probably what you would have expected if you saw libertarians in there confronted with the almighty policy clusterfuck that sort of they were confronted with. Now, you can take that argument or you can leave it, but I think the answer to the question, the interesting question that then is posed is, and this is not a question about political, what is politically popular or not, what would the appropriate libertarian policy response have been to the financial crises of the last several months? And I'm not sure.
I don't know. I don't know what that fulcrum moment was that when confronted with X, they did this and that was sort of a libertarian-y thing to do, presuming that the thing that they did was nothing. Because I mean, basically since. Oh, basically, after not long after Bear Stearns, the response has been to do as much as possible. There's been a great scrambling of coming up with new policies to create a troubled assets relief program, which was supposed to handle just these toxic assets, but then eventually was used to bail out auto parts manufacturers. I mean, there's been a frenzy of activity at the Federal Reserve level and elsewhere that has been very interventionist. I mean, I think it's interesting. We had did an interview mm-hmm. with Paul Atkins, who is basically a small L libertarian who was on the SEC for most of the Bush period. And I had heard him say before, I'd seen him, described in the press as a big deregulator. And so I thought I'd give him the big gotcha, which for me is like, okay, Mr. Deregulator, why were you against creating a sort of clearinghouse structure, mandating a clearinghouse structure to just sort of measure the trades of mortgage-backed securities and various credit default swaps and these kind of exotic instruments that are at the heart of this problem. And his response surprised me, which was that I tried. Turns out he was looking at all of that and saying, oh my God, this pile is just growing like that. It's off the charts. It's getting into the trillions, 58 trillion, I think is the last number on that thing. And we don't know how much people are trading and how much their exposure is. We got to figure that out. And according to his account, at the very least, and I don't have a reason to distrust him, when he brought that up, he was shouted down. They were much more interested in sort of perceived conflict of interest problems and a variety of kind of tangential regulatory issues mm-hmm. and not the thing in general. I mean, again, I think there's a misperception of sort of libertarians, especially when they finally kind of get into a place of government. By the time you're in the government, even if you call yourself the biggest Ayn Rand fanatic or whatever, or libertarian, you have already made a lot of accommodations to the reality. You're not going to go there and try to create the second Mogadishu. You're going to basically say, okay, where and how can we, in a very small way, use kind of market forces or maybe, reduce this budget from 100 million to 90 million or something like that. It's much more marginal on that level. Paul Atkins was a guy who said, okay, what are we here to do? If we're here to regulate this kind of trading activity, then let's regulate that, but let's not like saddle people with a bunch of sort of bogus make accounting work, which is a big criticism that libertarians have always had about Sarbanes-Oxley, for example, which played its own role, however, large, small, it's an area of dispute, but in this process by creating the mark-to-market accounting system, which then sort of forced banks and investment banks and financial institutions to value their assets at zero as they were, pertaining to anything related to credit default swaps and mortgage-backed securities and that kind of stuff. Anyways, again, long story short, I don't think that the libertarians who were near the scene of the crime were all necessarily saying, let's cut and run. I think a lot of them were saying, let's do something. A big exception to that is Alan Greenspan, who I think, again, is sort of misperceived as being very friendly to libertarian ideas. He's, in fact, the bête noire of like the Ron Paul / Austrian school of economic thought. They're very—they're not so keen on Federal Reserves and monopolistic currencies and all that kind of stuff.
They're also not so keen on Cato and the collectivists either, are they?
What's that? Sorry.
They're also not so keen on Cato or the sort of what they perceive as mainstream libertarians who have sold out. Is my perception.
There's the grand and quite overstated, but nonetheless pretty interesting sort of cosmotarian versus paleo libertarian split.
Yeah.
And it's, again, only when you're part of a seriously fringe movement can you actually divide the head of a pin even smaller and with more bitterness. But somehow libertarians managed to do that. But I think there was a moment.
Brendan Behan, the Irish author, had a thing that on the first meeting, this was back in the 1950s when the IRA was a very disorganized movement, that the first item on the agenda of any IRA meeting was always the split And I figure libertarianism and indeed left factionalism, it's the same story.
Which to me is sort of endlessly amusing. But I think that the one smoking gun that people point to is there was a moment, I guess, and you'll probably know this better than I do, when Alan Greenspan was sort of presented with, should we regulate these things? And he said no. And then he's since did a big mea culpa on Capitol Hill a few months back, saying, you know, it was my instinct to not regulate this because I believe in limited government and I am responsible for everything that happened, or whatever he said. But, you know, we try to work through these things kind of systematically. The reason we in our January issue, which was all about the economic crisis, we took a very rational approach and said, okay, did deregulation cause this? Let's what parts of deregulation had an impact on all this kind of stuff? And when you look at it closely like that, you don't get really easy sort of black and white answers. And I think it's incumbent upon people like us, certainly, to treat that as a journalistic question and to, you know, acknowledge error where it occurred. But I don't think that anyone can look at the response to this crisis and say, oh, my God, there are too many libertarians. I mean, it's really, I think, quite the opposite.
Well, I guess that wouldn't be, you know, if I wanted to look at the origin, I think that Wall Street friendly Democrats such as Rubin were just as much to blame as were, deregulation at all costs, people who were ideologically committed rather than committed because they were, they were aligned with certain views of the world which are congenial to business within the Democratic Party. So I don't think that this is but I guess my question is it's a simpler one, which is, okay, regardless who is to blame for this mess, regardless of whether deregulation is is what causes or is not what causes, if a libertarian was placed as a pragmatist in this situation of being the person who decided how to deal with this, what would the appropriate libertarian response be to the apparent and sort of likely crashing of the financial system, of major banking companies and whatever? Is there a more libertarian-friendly way of doing things than the way that we've done than the way that things were done? Is it that we didn't need to do anything in the first place, that we just should have left the markets to correct themselves? What is the libertarian pragmatic position here, I guess, for what should have been done instead?
To the extent that I can speak for that position, I would say that the root of the problem, the root of this financial crisis, are these mortgage-backed securities. This, you know, as Duncan Black has called it over the years, the big shit pile. I think any solution to that, any solution to the overall problem of the economy that emanated from that, has to drill down there. It is my belief that what you needed to do was allow there to be developed a market for those pieces of toxic assets. There never really has been. That's because the government of early on, as soon as they crossed the sort of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers threshold, has been in full, like, maximum response mode. At some point in 2008, Merrill Lynch had a pile of these assets, and they sold them off at something like 20 cents on the dollar. You could have, if you allow big financial institutions to go bankrupt, which doesn't mean total liquidation. It doesn't mean, you know, chaos in the streets. Bankruptcy is a process; it happens. Sometimes it's just a reorganization. If you suspended mark-to-market accounting rules, which made these institutions look worse than they actually were. And those rules were finally suspended or modified, I think, 1 week ago, which was about, at least 8 months too late. So if you had done that to begin with, maybe changed a little bit the margin call or capital requirements on financial institutions. But most importantly, by allowing financial institutions to go bankrupt, if that's what they need to do, you would have allowed for the market of these toxic assets to be created. They would have found a price. There is no such thing as a price of zero, which is what these assets were priced at according to accounting rules. It's just that they have this big pile of crap, and they can't, and they're unwilling to sell them for as low as the market wants them. So anything that delays the creation of that market, in my view, delays the pain. of those assets unwinding. And everything else in the economy, it's sort of a separate issue. It's related and all these kind of things. But we've gone down all these different rabbit holes of bailing out various car companies and everything like that. But if you wanted to drill down into the root of the crisis, it's how quickly can we get a wind-out market to be created among these toxic assets. And when the government is changing its policies willy-nilly on a pretty sort of like a constant basis of a bold experimentation and whatnot, then no one's going to trade. They're going to wait and see around what's the government going to do one way or the other. And that keeps that toxic core stuck. You need to unstuck the core. So in my view, the proper response, whether it's libertarian or not, is to create conditions where that core can be unstuck. And part of that is allowing companies to fail and to get rid of the notion that there is such a thing as too big to fail. I think we've gone in the opposite direction. We've delayed pain, and we're going to be seeing the after effects of this for potentially decades.
I guess, well, I disagree with this, but this would get into a much more extended debate. I think that mark to market is not the big villain here, and I think that a lot of the problem, as far as I can see from reading about this, is that the assets are simply too complicated to value very easily unless you make these assumptions about risk, which have been shown, these models have been shown not to work extraordinarily well. But I also think that there is a problem of being too big to fail here. And I think, if you look at some of the, there's a great book by a guy called McKenzie, which looks at the last time that the financial system nearly crashed, the ways in which people's images of the market. Anyway, we could get into this, but I think that one of the core issues here for you is maybe not so much the pragmatic issue of the response, which you clearly believe was the wrong response, that we didn't need to pay so much money, as you also believe that there's been a lot of what you characterize as on your blog as dishonesty by the Obama administration about the tax bill that's likely to go along with it. So do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Obama has developed this sort of tick of saying things, how to put this, that aren't true. He has said over and over again that, if you are if you make less than $250,000 a year, you won't see your taxes increase by one dime. Now, if he was talking just about Gesundheit, if he was talking just about federal income taxes, not of people but of households, then he's all, it's 75% instead of 90%, then he's sort of kind of right. But he said this in a lot of contexts that wasn't specific about federal income taxes. And you've seen him already hike, cigarette taxes by 68 cents a pack. He's called for some kind of carbon cap and trade or permits kind of process. Whatever happens with that, if something indeed happens, without a doubt, the whole point of the exercise is to make carbon more expensive. Everybody consumes carbon, ergo everyone's taxes are going to go up. He's sort of constantly saying these kinds of things that are easily refuted by what he says in the very next sentence, and this goes way beyond taxes. It goes things like, we don't want to run GM, and by the way, they really need to consolidate their brands. It's like, do you see the dissonance? But on taxes specifically, and this is true on tax day, he's a guy who said we're going to have a net spending cut and then unleash the biggest sort of budget increase since World War II. He's constantly contradicting himself, and at some point when the honeymoon begins to fade, which it will, I think people are going to be calling him on that. And meanwhile, all around the country, you see people hiking taxes like crazy. I mean, Hoboken, New Jersey had a 40% property tax increase this year. I mean, just imagine that. And sales taxes are being hiked in a dozen different states and various cities. California is just being taxed up the wazoo right now. My former hometown of L.A., Lord knows what the cumulative taxes are. And so I think taxes paid out as a global sort of share for Americans on all level is going to be up for basically everybody already. And then if his carbon tax schemes come through, then that's going to be all the more so. And this at a time when, you know, we're trying to stimulate the economy, trying to stimulate spending, get us back, you know, out there on, in the stores and all this kind of stuff, strikes me as kind of counterproductive at best.
Well, I guess I'm sort of my attitude on this is, first of all, I think that, you know, you're clearly right that the tax burden, because the tax burden depends on local taxes as well as federal taxes. It depends on sort of sales taxes and other things as well. And that burden is going to go up. Because the whether or not the cap and trade thing is going to get through, that seems to me to be a bit up in the air at the moment. But I also think that there's a very clearly a longer-term tax bill that's going to be associated with the stimulus spending, and that this is something which is, which is sort of being downplayed, I guess, both for politically strategic reasons and also, I think, for non-strategic reasons. So let me talk a little bit about. I think that it may be sort of a relatively responsible thing to be a little bit dishonest about this stuff from the point of view of Obama. And here, I'm thinking about the arguments that are being made about what this fiscal stimulus is supposed to do. And if you look at fiscal stimulus, there's a there is an argument out there among some economists, not all by any means, that that fiscal stimulus is self-cancelling in the long run, because if you have a stimulus today, you're going to have to pay for it with increased taxes tomorrow, and this is going to mean that sooner or later it's all going to balance. It's all going to balance out, because people in their consumption decisions today are going to take account of the fact that tomorrow they'll have less money to spend, and so on and so on and so on. I think that this argument, in its simple form, doesn't make any sense, because, or at least it doesn't seem to reflect the realities of how people actually behave and make economic decisions. But what it does suggest to me is that it may actually be a responsible thing for Obama to actually soft-pedal the extent to which taxes are indeed increasing, are going to increase in the future. Because if you want the stimulus to work, if you don't want it to be counterbalanced by people deciding to save their money or to spend less, then you may not want to give the broad impression that people, so that the economy is in trouble, that spending is going down, and that it's a good idea to save rather than to spend. Now, this is an argument which I make with some hesitation, because I think that arguments for a certain degree of selective honesty are always politically problematic arguments. But I also think that this is something where the verdict should be 2 years down the line. And maybe you're right that people are going to give Obama a lot of grief because he misled them. And I would suspect that over the longer term, taxes are going to go up on the middle class as well as on the wealthy at the federal level too. But it may also be that people look at this from a pragmatic perspective and decide that, whichever which way, we got through the crisis and we seem to be doing better than we would have done otherwise, and to let bygones be bygones. In other words, I'm not sure that this is necessarily a political, mortal, or grievous sin. It may just be one of these minor sins that I, as a Catholic, when I was growing up, used to get absolution from, with sort of three Hail Marys and a couple of Our Fathers and whatever you're having yourself.
Non-Catholic, as someone who's, probably the person who's influenced my political thinking more than any other human, is not necessarily a libertarian, but a playwright president, Václav Havel. His observation, and I think it's a good one, is that any policy by a government that depends, even in part, on a lie, is a policy that is not worth keeping and is ultimately going to be undermined. It'll undermine itself. It'll lose legitimacy among a population as soon as the population realizes that either it's being lied to or it's being asked to participate in a larger lie, which, by the way, is one reason why I think that eventually the drug war is doomed. Certainly the criminalization of marijuana is doomed because it requires us all to pretend that smoking marijuana is a terrible thing. It should be and that winners don't do drugs and all that kind of crap. Same, I think, can be said in this and other cases involving policy. If it's good policy, you don't need to lie. It's kind of that simple. And when you get into the game of, where everything depends on how you portray things and the signals that you receive and all this kind of stuff, to me, a government sets some rules Hopefully there are not a whole lot of them, but they act much more as an umpire rather than as a shaman, you know, sort of waving their hands and hoping that people will kind of act in this way or that way. Create your simple rules, or maybe they're complicated because of the crisis necessitates it or whatever, hopefully not, and then recede, and you know, and people will find their own levels. I don't think that necessarily you need to sort of to whip them in one direction or another. In this case, I mean, I think part of the mindset is like, well, none of the individual policies are necessarily ones that I would sign up on, but we need to do something. And this is, in many ways, the reason why government always grows, because whenever something happens, you need to do something. This is the same argument that was used, you know, to support the Patriot Act after September 11th. Well, by God, you know, there's a balance between liberty and security, so we need to do something. And it's always marginalized weirdos like us who say, well, wait a second, maybe you don't need to do something, or maybe you need to prove that the something that you're doing is worthwhile instead of just a frenzy of activity that somehow will, at the end of the day, kind of sort itself out. So I'm not a big fan of just sort of the Tasmanian devil style of governance, because among other things, in addition to leading you to places where you're, you know, being dishonest, it also, you know, it creates a spectacle of its own. Like, when is the Tasmanian devil finally going to calm down and maybe not punch me with his errant fists? It's when people realize that there's a stable set of rules and a predictable set of rules that they're going to be much more likely to act, to spend, to do the normal things of life.
I guess my response to that, and this is something which I'll acknowledge, there are a lot of gray areas here. I would have to think more carefully about where I think it's appropriate for politicians to shade the truth a bit, where it's not appropriate and whatever. I think that there is there's a lot of rhetoric in American politics. You know, so you're never going to get a U.S. president, you know, sort of coming out and saying, well, you know, so far interventions in the rest of the world are pretty self-interested. If you look at it on sort of whole aspects of, you know, sort of the U.S. and the U.S. society and culture massively suck. There's a certain level of rhetorical game playing here, which I think is sort of understood, at least to some extent, by both sides. In other words, when I think a politician comes out and says, I am not going to tax you, very often this is perceived as being a signal of type rather than necessarily an act of promise. It's basically signaling, I will do my damnedest not to tax you unless the circumstances really, really make it impossible for me to do otherwise. I think that that's a reasonable way of doing things. You know, so in other words, I think that if you're somebody, you know, this is something you can come up with a complicated game theoretic explanation for, but if you're somebody who's basically signaling, who starts off saying, I'm going to raise taxes where I see it as being necessary, I think people are going to discount that and say, this is somebody who's not only saying that he's going to raise taxes when he believes it's necessary, who's going to raise taxes at every possible opportunity, and then they're not going to vote for the guy. So in other words, I think that being actively honest about taxes in the sense of saying what it is that you sort of are actually truly believe in your heart of hearts on this topic is going to get you into trouble, because people are not going to believe that you're telling the truth. In fact, they're going to believe that you're worse, your intentions are on the tax front are worse than they in fact are.
But here's where it gets kind of even psychologically interesting for me. Yes. What happens if you're a politician? Okay, let's say that there is, you know, politicians are going to fudge, they're going to lie, whatever. But what happens if a large part of your appeal is that you are a preternatural truth teller? You and you alone are going to change business as usual in politics and in Washington. You know, John McCain was very much that. That's what attracted to me as a him to me as a subject to begin with, is that he was portraying himself as like, you know, finally I'm the person sent down to tell the blunt truth that people in Washington are unwilling to accept, which is always an interesting proposition. And usually someone who says that with a certain amount of fervid conviction, even after they've been shown to not be telling the truth, it suggests something about their personality, which frankly to me is alarming. You know, Obama called his first budget a new era of fiscal responsibility, or a new era of responsibility. There is just no way you can look at his first budget, which increases spending by something like 39% and creates the biggest debt load and the biggest spike in debt since World War II. You cannot look at that and say, finally, we are being responsible to future generations and beginning to pay down the debt. It is the opposite of that. And what does it say about a politician who's going to look you in the eye very close and lie to you and do the opposite of what he says? To me, that is actively worrying. And I worry that about that with Obama, not because I dislike him, but because I like him. You know, in many ways, I like him as a person more than any president I can remember in my lifetime. Maybe it's because, you know, I'm starting to become of presidential age or something like that, but he seems to sort of speak in my overall language, and he's, you know, he's an attractive character in many ways, and, you know, occasionally I will agree with one of his policies, and I'm happy on those days. But when a guy cloaks himself as bringing the new truth, and he's going to be more honest, finally, more responsible than other people, and then the exact same policy that he's introducing in these language is really the opposite of what he's saying, that suggests to me a certain pathology, one that makes me very uncomfortable.
Well, that's a slightly different thing and something which I would actually disagree with more, which is to say, I don't think that it's necessarily at all irresponsible to increase spending by a substantial amount. Because if I look at the international figures, U.S. government spending is relatively low among advanced industrialized democracies, and you know, this betrays the fact that I'm a lefty social democrat. I think that we should have a lot more spending on many of these topics. And here I'm looking at the speech he made today, where I think he pretty clearly laid out his case in this. He was saying, okay, there is this stuff which I'm looking for large spending increases in the areas of healthcare, in the areas of environment, in the areas of this, that, and the other. But this is, you know, the equivalent of somebody who, when they're faced with some sort of tight financial resources, they continue to spend money, put money aside for their kids' education because they believe that that's putting money away for the future. Now, you may, I think, very reasonably disagree with the claim that he's making here if you believe that having a sort of a large expansion of healthcare spending or cap and trade or whatever are not good ideas. But I think that one can't necessarily say that it is dishonest of him to say that he is being responsible in putting this forward and in putting these large spending increases forward, because from a pretty plausible account of responsibility, which I think a lot of people would agree with, he is actually being quite responsible.
Except for that, he ran explicitly on a campaign in which he said, we are going to see a net spending cut. My first budget is going to contain a net spending cut. Those are his words. Those aren't my words. He's the one who said responsibility equals facing down our debt, or our deficit means discontinuing sort of emergency supplemental spending on wars, all this kind of stuff. He laid those signposts up there. It wasn't me. I'm judging him by his own words. So he didn't run on a campaign of we're going to increase spending by 30%. Yes, he did talk about his 5 million green jobs and healthcare and these kind of things. So we cannot be surprised at the initiatives. But we can hold him directly accountable to his own methods of measuring his own policies. And on those accounts, he's been totally dishonest. And he hasn't been called out for it that much, I don't think. And that, I think, is just going to encourage him.
Well, maybe so, but I also think that, part of it, I think that there probably was some dishonesty initially, which is to say that I don't think that he could have done many of the things that he wanted to do without substantially raising spending. But I also think that there is a, I think he's going to get an easier time for it, because nobody expected that we were going to be facing the massive financial crisis that we have been facing. And this clearly does have some significant repercussions in terms of, you know, so what kinds of things you want to spend money on, what kinds of things you don't want to spend money on. And here I think, you know, so when we elect politicians, you know, so we are not running a direct democracy here. If the politicians break a promise, if a politician breaks a promise that he has made or she has made, that politician can surely and should surely be held accountable at the next election. But there are some circumstances under which we actually and actively want politicians to break their promises. If circumstances change so that a course which had been promised turns out to be an unwise course, we do not want the politician necessarily to stick to that course. If the politician makes a bad judgment call and decide, or else is, you know, sort of flagrantly dishonest and does something which has no justification post hoc, then surely that person deserves to get their ass kicked out of office at the next election. But I think that's the reason why we delegate responsibility, because we recognize that there are some things which we are not simply not going to be expected to anticipate, able to anticipate, and that's why politicians' promises are not cast iron contracts.
Two quick points, because we've reached the 1 hour limit, 1 hour and 3 minutes, according to my counter here. One is that his sort of net spending cut language was delivered in, I believe, mid to late October. It was certainly well after the financial crisis had hit. It was in the context of the financial crisis. So there weren't all that many surprises left coming in terms of the enormity of what was facing us. And the other one is just simply on one level, I do agree that basically, you know, who cares if it's a promise or not? If it's good policy, I'd like it. I'd feel a lot better about that if I thought what he was doing was good policy, which I clearly, is, in terms of specifically of economics, do not. But with that, we should wrap up. I think that means we're going to save global warming and reasons, nuanced position thereof, for another time. This has been a great treat to hash these things out, and it was nice talking to you.
Great talking to you as well.
Okay, bye, Henry.
Okay, bye.